You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 60 of Atheistically Speaking with your host Thomas Smith. Alright, I want to start the show off real quick on a positive note. I meant to do this a while ago, and apologies to anyone who thinks this is indulgent, but I want to thank people so much who have written iTunes reviews. I really appreciate it, and it really helps the show because I'm still stuck down in the weird rankings of iTunes podcasts, and I think reviews helps. So I just wanted to reference Lilith Pride is the name of the user, and the review says, "Well thought out. This has become one of my favorite atheist podcasts. Not only do they, Thomas and often guest, discuss topics in depth, they also tend to read out articles they are discussing, bringing a good literary boost to atheist podcasting. Thomas, continue to read from time to time, as that is something I don't get to as often on my own. Will do. Sir or madam." And, you know, I read the bad reviews too, so I'm not going to read them on the air, but yeah, I read them all. But, no, I really appreciate it. And, I'm going to pick a review to read out. And if you want to say something, to the rest of the listeners, and then go write a review and, you know, I'm going to read it. Not all of them, but I'll read some of them. Okay. So today we have continuing the discussion with CJ. Now, I have a lot more I want to say on Ferguson. You know, not too much more on PZ Myers, honestly. That was decently well received. A few people disagreed a little bit. But I think it, I don't know. I think it, with the people who did disagree with what I said, had more of a problem with other things than with like how I, with my PZ stuff, you know, and I understand, and I want to make sure I'm taking every part of it seriously, because I think that a tactic some people use sometimes, atheists I don't like, well, not just atheists, anyone that, you know, online kind of trolls, will be like freedom of speech warriors, where someone will be harassing someone and then you call them out on it and then they, you know, defend freedom of speech, and they'll get outraged about freedom of speech, but they're not outraged about, you know, harassment. So I bring that up as an, I don't ever want to fall into that where there's a great injustice happening and I'm busy, you know, criticizing how PZ Myers reacted to it. I don't want to be that at all. And that's why I started off with an analysis of the situation itself first. And I believe that. I don't, you know, that wasn't me trying to like manipulate anything. That I strongly believe the most important thing. I've been wanting to tweet this 100 times every day. Why isn't there a freaking dashboard camera footage? I cannot believe that's not a law. It would just clear everything up. I think that I've signed the online petition. I encourage everyone else to. I don't know if that does anything. I hope it does. And I encourage demonstrations. I encourage all that as regards the, you know, the demographics of the police force. That's another big problem. All that. I didn't want to minimize all that. I didn't want that to get lost in my critique of PZ. That shouldn't, you know, that should come second. And I meant it to, and I hope it came across that way. So, all right. I don't want to distract anymore from a great interview with CJ. The news kind of happened after this had recorded. So there, you know, it's a little weird in the timing. That's why the, you know, the Tom and Terry kind of, the tone was a little different between the Tom and Terry, the interview, but, it was a great interview. So I want to get right to that with CJ. And then next week I'm going to have, I'll probably have a bit more to say on the entire situation. Lots of thoughts, lots of different things going on, more bad, terrible news in the world. But without further ado, here's the great CJ Werlemann. It's almost like we're really passive aggressive or something. Doesn't it seem like we want to have these little, you know, agreements amongst our own sides and like really talk shit on the other side amongst each other. But then when, you know, when you have the relatives over, you know, you have the friends over that, you know, are a different view, then it's like, oh, well, politics, religion off the table. You know, it seems kind of passive aggressive, wouldn't you say?
I would say it's passive aggressive, but also too, we're so frightened that it's going to end in fisticuffs or, you know, personal attacks, because I think both parties in any potential debate feel that they don't have much more to offer other than, you know, something, you know, that's hyperbolic. You know, their government's, government's a big evil monster that, you know, sucks the marrow off the bone of taxpayers and blah, blah. Well, of course, there's an argument to have that government can be wasteful and we should look for opportunities to, you know, reform government and make it more efficient. But to just throw out completely that all government is wasteful and government's never done anything is just not supported by empirical evidence. You know, the US federal government, you know, lifted this country out of its worst economic crisis, you know, in the 20th century, the Great Depression. So, you know, but, you know, when you've got Fox News, just when you've got Reagan who started, you know, government's not part of the solution, it is the problem, then you can't have a sensible debate from that point because you're starting from a position that it's just evil.
Well, yeah, sure. And I'll try to venture into this because I've definitely taken some things from what you said, especially in the Rogan podcast and elsewhere. I'm pretty negative on government, but I'm not positive on anything that the Republican Party's offering. So I do hear you.
Yep.
I work in state government, and there's about 100 microcosm examples a day of just inefficiency and just terrible management, just stuff, even at the state level, that I can't handle. And just the amount of waste that there is nationwide. Now, that's not to say, like you said, I mean, that doesn't mean that they can't accomplish anything or that we have like a better option, I guess. But I certainly am a bit negative on government, and it makes it hard to want to increase the national tax revenue because one of the issues you brought up was, you know, trickle down economics doesn't work. But it's interesting, the government does take in a shitload of money in taxes. And why is it that that money isn't helping at all? I mean, that we do have income disparity that is, jaw dropping. It definitely seems to be a huge problem. Why is it that it needs to be more taxes than it is now, or what would you say is going on there? Because it's not like they don't have money. I mean, what's happening?
Well, they don't have enough money. Problem is that the Republican Party's fiscal policy towards tax revenue has been, you know, inverted commas, to starve the beast. Starving the beast means depriving the federal government of the revenue it needs to build infrastructure, build a prosperous economy. Therefore, everything will be privatized. When you starve the beast of the federal government's revenues, you run up huge deficits. When you run up huge deficits, the Republican Party turns around and uses that as an excuse to cut services, to safety nets, welfare programs, and infrastructure. Also provides excuse that the solution is not government, that we need to replace it with privatization. Therefore, under the Bush years, you had, you know, the move to try and privatize Social Security, which, you know, Bush found out pretty quickly that Americans indeed actually do like socialism or parts of socialism. They like the military and they like Social Security. The problem is it's not that you and I aren't paying enough tax, nor is anyone in the middle class. The problem is since Reagan, the last three decades, and Clinton is equally culpable in this because, you know, basically Ronald Reagan killed liberalism in this country and then Clinton buried its body. Clinton Democrats embraced the sanctity of the free market. And in doing so, they put all that tax burden which comes into the middle of the country. So the rich and the corporations are paying their lowest contribution to the federal government in US history. For every $1 that individuals like you and I pay it towards that the federal government receives from individuals like you and I, it's only receiving today 25 cents from the corporations. Now, the Republican Party will defend that and say, but corporations in this country are paying one of the highest corporate tax rates in the world. That's only on paper. The effective tax rate in this country, the effective tax rate, which is what corporations actually pay after they get all the deductions and loopholes, which they have written into the tax code themselves through their lobbyists in Washington, is actually 12%, which makes it the lowest tax rate amongst OECD countries. Now, And then certain industries have even greater loopholes on top of that. Mining and gas, which not only is, fast forwarding our our inevitable death, in the next generation or two with climate change or a generation after that, they actually are only paying 2.7% of their income towards the federal government. So the federal government is being starved of the income, which is why America doesn't have nice things anymore. It's why we don't have, a high-speed rail network. It's why we don't have, bridges that don't collapse into the rivers below them. It's why all of our airports in this country, you look like an airport you would land at in Bangladesh. I don't know if to Asia lately, but if you land at Shanghai, Bangkok, Kuala Lumpur, Seoul, these airports look like space stations. The cities look like space stations. You land at the airport at this space station, you get on a high-speed bullet train, and you're in a city in 10 minutes. but we accept LaGuardia. We accept Los Angeles that doesn't have a monorail or a high-speed rail because we don't have the money to invest in. But we did invest in these programs after the collapse in the Great Depression with FDR's New Deal. And we've moved so far away from liberalism that America is now, a two-class society, the rich and the poor.
Now, I'm curious about that statistic, because isn't it still true that, the top X percent pays, 57, 60? This is why I'm not qualified to have this discussion. But the stat you hear is often that the top, 10% of people pay 80% of the taxes or something. What would that be? You would know that.
Yeah, but that's federal income tax. And you're right, Republicans will use that as a defense. They'll say, but the burden's on the rich because of course. I mean, but they're paying the lowest. It always has been on the rich. In every, modern Western democracy, the burden is always on the rich. But we've shifted to the burden to the middle class. And so the poor, they'll say, but the poor pay no income taxes, but they pay state taxes. They pay, payroll taxes. They're actually paying a bigger percentage of their income in taxes and what the rich are, which is why Warren Buffett said that, I pay a third of the income tax at my secretary.
Sorry, I guess. Did you call him Warren Buffet? Because I'm going to have to call you out on that.
Yeah, sorry, I was speaking so fast. That I
he sounds delicious. That Warren Buffet.
I was trying to give him a French sounding.
making him sound fancier than he is.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Good call, but good catch. Can you edit this out later?
Too late.
Now I look like a spassy. So they'll defend it and in that means. America's most prosperous economic period was from 1949 to 1979. Productivity grew 98% in that three-decade period. But wages also grew in that period by 87%. Now, if you take the year that Reagan was elected from 1980 to 2010, productivity rose slightly less than what it did, about 80-something-odd percent, but wages only grew 4%. So we've moved so far from the FDR socialism, New Deal liberalism, which is what Western European countries have, which is what Canada and Australia have, to pure unfettered capitalism that we've destroyed the middle class, we've decimated the poor, and we've just enriched the rich like no other wealthy class on the planet.
Let me ask you a few questions. And again, I'm really just undecided on politics. I think I likely agree a large percentage with you. I just want to make clear that I'm probably posing a lot of these questions as devil's advocate or whatever. I don't mean to say that I was I just don't want anyone to think I was advocating Reaganomics or something. But there are some interesting philosophical things I've thought about. Maybe you won't find them interesting. Maybe you will. But when you talk about it's one thing to talk about corporations. Let's separate that just for a minute. But when you talk about the rich, philosophically, how do you justify the fact that a rich person, uses the same amount of resources as someone else? So they send two kids or however many kids to a school, assuming they actually send them to a public school, in which case if they send them to a private school, they're using fewer public resources. But from that standpoint, using, use of shared resources and all that, an individual person, who's very wealthy, is using the same amount of resources, yet is expected to pay a lot more for them. And I'm wondering if you've thought about that. I'm sure you have. And what your sort of philosophical response to that argument would be.
You know, somebody you can say who is very wealthy is actually using more of the public good or the common good.
How is that?
Well, they're going to have more staff to begin with, or more employees. Therefore, they're benefiting from more employees who have been employed, you know, who have been educated through the public education systems. Therefore, they're going to be, you know, have a bigger carbon footprint, everything from they're going to, you know, they could have a big impact.
Well, let's say, okay, I was trying to separate out some, you know, like a bit. Let's say an executive or somebody who makes a large salary but doesn't actually have employees. You know, somebody who maybe is very high up in a company. I'm just trying to look at it, the individual standpoint, because corporations, they have to pay taxes separately over and above. So that some of those objections you just raised could be answered by the fact that the company itself has to pay taxes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if we're separating corporations from the rich now, that is different. And also too, you have to define what is rich first.
Sure.
For example, if somebody living in Oklahoma is earning $400,000 a year, they are flying.
Yeah.
But if a doctor earning $400,000 in New York City, that doctor
can barely make rent.
Yeah. And I'm sure he doesn't consider himself rich.
Sure.
But
for my purposes, I don't know that that's terribly important, because I am sort of talking about up the gradient of tax bracket. Just philosophically, for an individual who's using the same amount of resources, how should they have to pay more for those resources?
Well, they're earning, philosophically, they're earning more money, and, you know, that they can essentially. Yeah. And they're, you know, you can argue that they're, you know, they're taking more money, out of circulation, out of the economy. So, you know, when the rich buy stocks and bonds, or bonds in particular, or stock, or it could be stocks, there's no social value to that. So bond traders or executives on Wall Street, when they're moving pips around on a screen and there's no trading taxes or anything like that, and they're taking those $10 million incomes, or hedge fund managers, there's no social capital that's coming back into the economy, because they're not spending it. It just stays money on the screens. Whereas if you have the poor, give the poor less burden of the tax, less of the tax burden, well, they're going to spend everything they earn, which goes in the economy, which is taxed more, which benefits society as a whole. You have to start from the point, the way you're looking at it is kind of starting it from how I would look at it in reverse. You're saying, well, why should the rich pay more? I'm saying, well, it has to be, the common good has to be taken consideration. And if you accept the premise that there is a common good, then you have to figure out how you're going to pay for it. And therefore, obviously, the rich have to pay more for it.
Interesting. Yeah, I was trying to start from that level on purpose. So the answer would be that because there's this common good that is good and is needed, people with more need to pay more for it because they can, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm talking about.
It's tough. I mean, honestly, I think I agree, but I'm not sure why. Just philosophically, I'm not sure that there's some level on which it does seem kind of weird that if you use the same amount of resources, you do have to pay more because
what's that? For example, a good example is libertarians, you know, should it be like a flat tax? Everybody pays equal. You know, why should the rich have to pay for it? Well, and then you end up with a country that looks like, you know, a broken banana republic, where you have no infrastructure, where you have no healthcare, you have no, a feudal.
Well, what if the level of the flat tax was adjusted so that it would be an incredible amount of revenue, and you could use that revenue to build the infrastructure? I mean, what is it assumed that a flat tax would be lower total revenue than it is now?
Yeah, it would be, because it's a regressive tax.
Why would it be? What if the flat tax was 99% of everyone's income? I think it's weird to assume that it's going to be a lower.
But then you would have no consumer demand, because the consumers.
I know. I'm just saying it shouldn't be assumed that it's going to be a lower overall tax revenue. It could be a flat tax of 40, 7% or something, and be.
But if, yeah, exactly. But if you made it higher, and then, you know, as I said, you're not going to have consumers that are going to be able to create demand, and if you can't create demand, then, you know, products can't be distributed from corporations. But sorry, the point I was going to make was
sure.
that you know, libertarian argument works up until the point that their common good needs to be acknowledged. For example, in a libertarian utopia, I have, you know, I have money in my hand. And I want to go. I want to walk down the street to you know, the local quickie mart, and I want to buy a 6-pack of beer. I walk down to the beer, pay the shopkeeper his money. I walk back home. Everybody's happy. I've got my beer. He's got his money, and you know, he's made a profit from the, you know, the difference, the margin on the product. Now, that's all fine and good until I want to walk down there, and it happens to be in the middle of the night, and I need streetlights to see where I'm going. Now. Who pays for the street right? The streetlights. That has to be, you know, because the free market's not going to pay for it, because there's no, they're only concerned with a, you know, a profit motive. Corporations have no interest in the common good. You know, they only have, you know, one fiduciary goal, and that's to derive maximum profit for their shareholders. So, and if a corporation did, out of the goodness of its own heart, which corporations don't have, they would be, then they paid for it out of their own money. Then you would have mooches benefiting off the system, getting free streetlights. So, yeah, once you acknowledge the fact that there is a common good, whether that's education, streetlights, public safety nets, education, then you have to figure out how you're going to pay for it. And therefore, the higher income owners naturally have to pay a greater share.
Well, I think. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say that there's no common good. I 100% there's a common good. And I think that here's the problem as I see it, because I've thought a lot about you've written about how, you know, I think did we talk about it on someone else's show? I can't remember. Libertarianism being just sort of a pipe dream, that sort of thing, like unsupported by evidence. Else. What's that?
It might've been with someone else. I don't
remember. Yeah, I don't know. It sounds familiar, but anyway, I think I kind of understand the desire for libertarianism to be something that you'd want to subscribe to. I think that a lot of atheists, because it does seem like there's a lot of atheist libertarians, wouldn't you say? I mean,
oh, lots.
Yeah.
SE Cup, Karl Rove, you know.
Well, we'll have to talk about SE Cup in a minute. Yeah, and yeah. I can kind of understand to a certain extent, although I think I ultimately disagree with it for some of the same reasons that you do, I'd suspect. But I think what happens is there is the alienation that you've even mentioned, a distrust of both parties, of even the Liberal Party, and then certainly the Conservative Party. And so there's this desire for, like, give me something else, you know, give me something else I can believe in. Go ahead.
No, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Keep going.
Yeah, I'm just saying, in terms of the, I can understand the appeal of thinking, well, I just kind of want to live and let live. Personally, I would never say that. I don't think I'd be going for this libertarian, you know, utopia idea that you outlined, because it sounds unrealistic. I will always believe that there must be taxes and there must be a certain amount taken care of course. But the desire for an alternative to our current parties, plus what I have identified in my life and my job and in just in experience and reading as terrible waste by the government, I can see that leading toward, like, man, I just want to cut the system quite a bit and seek this alternative. But go ahead. I can understand why it's a problematic philosophy.
Well, libertarianism appeals to a lot of non-believers is sort of fact. If you look at atheism demographically, atheists tend to be white, better educated, and more financially well off than the general population. When you're white and you're well off, you don't tend to see the economy through the prism of your own eyes. You don't get to see the financial and financial inequalities which are caused by racial disparities, number one. Problem with libertarianism, and also too, it's a contrarian position, libertarianism.
Yeah,
I think a lot of atheists are appealed to that as well. I think everybody goes through a libertarian stage at some point in their life, particularly, you know, college students. But then when you start to really understand how an economy works, you see that it can't work. I mean, for example, it basically removes faith from human beings, puts enormous faith in corporations. But history has proven that, you know, the corporations are only concerned with that profit motive. Now, it's ridiculous and absurd for anyone to put faith in corporations being concerned for human beings and the common good. When you look at, take any number of examples. Look at the Ford Pinto. I mean, Ford knew before the Ford Pinto was released onto market that it had a gas cylinder problem, that it blew up in occasions. But they did a cost-benefit analysis, and their cost-benefit analysis told them that it would better to still go ahead and release the car, deal with the fatalities, and build that in as a built-in cost rather than withdraw and not release that car at all. So you need government government oversight to make sure to keep the, you know, these companies releasing faulty products onto the market, whether it's food, whether it's cars, whether it's seatbelts in cars, whether it's the tobacco industry, whether it's big oil and gas, because they don't care for the common good unless the people monitor and keep these companies in check.
Let me add to that too. Because I used to think this way. I do have a bit of schooling in economics. I'm no expert, but I've taken more classes than your average person. And I used to think a bit that way, too. I think back when I was trying to, reconcile with my being raised conservative, I was trying to justify it. But then it kind of hit me one day, like, in theory, sure, the market could correct for all this stuff. But, that's not too much consolation to the people who, lose their lives or something because, they're in that mid period where a corporation or a company or anybody put out a bad product and it resulted in the deaths of several people. That's not much consolation to them or their families when, a few years goes by and the market corrects for it. I totally agree with that. I would never say that we shouldn't have regulation. I think we should have a ton of regulation. One thing,
where would we be? Imagine where we'd be today if we, without government regulation, where big tobacco would be today. I mean, it's frightening to even imagine. Look what deregulation, three decades of deregulation to Wall Street. 3 decades of government deregulation, the stripping of the funding for the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, led to, the blowing up of the entire financial universe, effects of which we're unlikely to get out of the next decade or so.
See, I may be unique in this. I really have no idea, but I'm far more sympathetic to regulation. I'm a big fan of regulation as long, do our best to make it reasonable. A big fan of that, and I would be pro a ton of regulation before I'd be pro more taxes, but that might be a little backwards.
Yeah, but you got to pay for that regulation. See, by starving the federal government,
we're paying it so much.
that's because you and I shouldn't be. The taxes for the middle class should be lowered.
I could go for that. I could go for like a hard cutoff. I don't know, whatever it is. Maybe you try to take into account, like you said earlier, what city you're living in or something, some sort of cost of living adjustment. But after cost of living, I'd be pro, like, a cutoff of like, I don't know, 100 grand, something, whatever the number would be. I'm nowhere near that, but somewhere where above that, you'd be, total taxes, and below that, just 0% taxes. I could go for that.
Yeah. I mean, but that's if, in a healthy liberal democracy, the tax burden is shifted from the middle class. It's put, at the top. Remember when we had the greatest era of economic prosperity in this country, in the period from just after the war to 1970, and that's when the tax rate was 91% on the top earners. And that tax rate of 91% on the top income earners in the 50s certainly didn't, restrict productivity. We had the greatest productivity. And in fact, it was a Republican president, Eisenhower, who said in 1956, when the tax rate, top marginal rate was 91%, any attempt to lower the top marginal tax rate would be immoral. That's how far we've come from,
That is quite unbelievable. I mean, I would love to look that up, but I assume you have that right. That's extraordinary when you look at today, how different the perceptions are.
Imagine if a Republican candidate in a presidential primary said the tax rate should, if lowering the tax rate from 91% would be immoral.
Yeah, let's lower it to like 85%. Yeah, no, I could go for that. I was going to just make a little observation earlier. I wonder if this libertarianism, which I'm sympathetic to certain aspects of it, but I wonder if it maybe had its home in a time before corporations could wield so much power. I mean, the internet and just the spread of technology and such has just made it so that, you know, groups, well-funded groups of people can do so much more than they could. I mean, a big company was not quite as threatening. I don't know what the 1800s or something. I mean, they're not capable of doing as much harm as fast as maybe they are now.
Well, and I say the problem is too that, you know, we've become such a, you know, Sheldon Wallen writes this in his book, you know, Democracy Incorporated. America has become a corporate totalitarian state. It's all about monopolies now. In any pick an industry, there's only four or five companies which are players in an industry, whether it's food.
I was just railing on Comcast last week.
Well, there you go.
My listeners will know.
Yeah. What was it, 40 years ago, there was, you know, 90 media companies that, you know, shared in 50% of the media market. Now there's six companies that have 90% of the media market, something like that. Those numbers aren't exactly right, but... You know,
well, there's where regulation. See, I'm happy with regulation. I'd be happy with the monopoly busting. I'm pro that.
Yeah, but what's happened with now? You know, if business was all small business, you know, a small business owner operates his small business, you know, in Main Street in a small town. Everybody knows that small business owner. There's a human to human connection. That person can't rip off his customers. He can't, you know, abuse his staff because he's got to hold his head. He's got to walk around town. He's got to, you know, take his kids to the local school. Everybody knows the shop owner by his name. But now the corporations become so large and so monopolistic that whatever small business emerges, it gets swallowed up by this massive entity. And in fact, these corporations in this country are so large now, they're not even the top 20 shareholders on any of the Fortune 500 companies. None of them are individuals. So the top 20 shareholders on these corporations are other corporations, you know, institutional investors. So people, the human element from doing business is so far removed from the human needs of a community or the individual, it's absurd. And that's why we have these massive income disparities. And that's why we're heading towards, you know, why America is clinically depressed. You know, this country, you know, compared to socialist liberal democracies like Western Europe and Australia, where we have 6 weeks annual leave, where we have universal health care, where we have free access to education or affordable access to education, why we're so darn happy in these countries and why America ranks 17th on the World Happiness Index. We're killing ourselves to death with this unfettered capitalism. And libertarianism, to come back to that point, would only make that worse. It would only put more power in the hand of this corporation and less in the hands of the people.
Sure. I think I would agree with that. I mean, I you know, I'm not too political a guy, but I think I could go for a lot of these ideas. I'm very pro-capitalism, though. I just like regulation as well. I think capitalism accomplishes, you know, a ton. I think it's really the only way to go, personally.
Capitalism, there's nothing, I'm not anti-capitalism, but you've got to have, you know, the right blend, you know.
Sure.
And you have the right blend in Scandinavia, for example. But here it's so off-kilt that, you know, it's killing us and impoverishing us.
Is there a level, I'll just ask you, that you would worry that if say the corporate or the individual tax rate was at such a level, could there be a danger of companies just leaving the country and going elsewhere? Would there be an opportunity for some other country to say, oh, hey, our tax rate is 10%. So almost nothing. U.S., you're back to 90%, let's say. Is that a danger?
They're doing it now. Even with the effective tax rate as low as it is, one of the lowest, well, just about the lowest in the, you know, amongst OECD countries at 12%, they're already moving. Look at Walgreens. Walgreens is planning on moving to domiciling in Switzerland. Nothing is going to change to their business. The same board, American board, will stay in place. Their head offices will stay here in the U.S.
But
nothing
we won't have that revenue, will we? Or do we have a certain amount of it because
that will that will take $5 billion out of revenue over the next 10 years.
So what's the solution to that?
is protecting. You protect trade. You punish businesses that do that. You charge tariffs for
outside companies?
Exactly. Foreign, you treat it as a foreign investor, and foreign investment companies always pay a higher tax rate to do business in that country. And that's a company which is dependent on federal money because, you know, a lot of their business is through Medicare and Medicaid. So, you know, and that's why Bernie Sanders, you know, who's a damn good socialist, has put forward a bill in the Senate to punish these companies severely if they do that.
Hmm.
I mean, to, you know, if you're going to move, if you're going to move your company overseas, well, you got to, you know, more than he's saying, all right, if you move your company overseas and you want us to treat a, treat you as an overseas company, and that more than 50% of your board has to be a foreigner.
Interesting. It seems a little too easy to say that, well, we could crank up the tax. You already have people leaving, as you've said, you already have companies leaving, which I think bolsters my point. But if we increase this rate, you'd have even more companies leaving, but then we're also going to say, we'll tax you even more if you leave. That it's, that's a, sounds a little too good to be true to me. I don't, it would be hard for me to believe that that would, that the, there wouldn't be a hit to the economy.
We used to have, you know, America used to have, you know, protect its industries with laws like that. But then Clinton came along, you know, so-called phony, you know, well, a phony liberal, and, you know, instituted NAFTA, which not only has drained the U.S. economy of 800,000 jobs, but has also destroyed Mexico, has displaced 3 to 4 million Mexican farmers off their farm, and is part of the reason why these countries in South Central America are so destabilized because there's no employment opportunities. So we've got these corporations writing the laws in Congress which want free trade agreement after free trade agreement, which is basically an excuse for these corporations to outsource every part of their supply chain to impoverished nations and deprive U.S. and pay lower tax rates and deprive, you know, the U.S. of further jobs. And this whole Republican policy, economic policy, which the Democrats have sadly embraced under Clinton, has America in this never-ending death spiral to the bottom. And, you know, if you look at, you know, the southern states, the American South is bad for the American economy the same way that Mexico and China is bad for the American economy. In the southern states, they offer lower tax rates, no pesky unions to deal with, no environmental regulations or no environmental regulations, full stop. They get corporate taxpayer-funded tax breaks and subsidies to move. And if you look at Toyota, Toyota recently moved from blue state California to Texas, with the promise of all these, you know, state-funded, or, you know, all these benefits of, you know, lower unions, lower cost of doing business. California was faced with a choice. Do we cut our own throat to compete this and end up in a never-ending death spiral to the bottom or a race to the bottom, or do we hold our ground and just go, well, that's, you know, we have to offer something better to companies. And they've chosen the moral high ground for now. And it'll be interesting to see if, you know, we can ward off these in-house parasites, which are the Republican-controlled southern states.
Hmm. Man, I don't know. I don't know how that's going to work. I don't know what incentive people would have to stay, or companies would have to stay in a higher tax state.
Well, higher federal minimum wage is one thing. You know, you go, fuck it. It's got to be $15 an hour. You know, you can't have where, you know, California is off. You know, California has $8.50 or roughly, you know, minimum wage. But you've got these states in the southern states that are paying $7.25, or some states that are offering a $10 minimum wage now. You know, like Seattle, Washington, and you know, whereas, you know, states like Tennessee are still offering $7.25 an hour. If you've got a federal minimum wage which is lifted to that point, then it makes it harder for these southern states to lure businesses away on the promise of cheaper wages. You've got to make it more difficult for these parasites to do business. At the moment, we are in this never-ending death spiral to the bottom because we've got to compete with a third world country that's within our own borders.
And people would argue, especially, you know, I know small business owners, they would argue that it would be very difficult for a small business to exist with that kind of minimum wage. And especially when you talk about people who are wanting businesses to pay more benefits and all that. What do you think about that? I mean, will that in turn make it more of a corporate state when small businesses have a harder time competing because they can't make that minimum wage, but maybe a bigger corporation can.
Struggling is not because the reason small struggle is not by lifting the minimum wage, because it would mean a small business operating in town. It means, you know, the consumer class has more to spend, and therefore they're going to sell more goods. Now, the Republican Party likes to, for example, and I talk about this in my book, likes to present itself as the party of small business. Name a single thing the Republican Party has done for small business. They like saying that because small business presents this imagery of, you know, a mar and pa store in small town America, and it seems quaint and something that we know well intimately. It's a good narrative that paints a picture in your mind. But where have Republicans been in protecting small business against these monopolies? Where has the Republican Party been when these Republican states have been when they're doling out taxpayer corporate subsidies to Walmart to move into a community and decimate jobs in a community? I mean, you help small business by ensuring that the citizens of that state and that town are doing well.
Personally, I'm not totally convinced. I agree with some of that. I'm not totally convinced that the higher minimum wage somehow will lead to enough increased income for a small business to be able to pay employees for a variety of reasons. I mean, if that were true, it would make total sense to just have a $20 minimum wage, $30 minimum wage. I mean, when you're trying to get back that money, you're paying your employees that entire cost times, you know, X number of hours a year. But really, you're only going to see the return of a little bit of increased sales, and you're only getting your margin on those returns. So there's no way it pays for itself.
FDR said it best. Any business that is dependent on paying its staff poverty level wages does not deserve to be in business. You need to re-examine your business model. I mean, in Australia, we have a minimum wage that's, you know, part beyond $15. Small business does well down there. In Europe, in Western Europe and Scandinavia, you have minimum wages, which are equivalent to a lot. If you're paying someone $7.25 per hour, they're spending 100% of what they earn. At $10.10, they're still going to be spending 100% of what they earn. There's still no savings at that level. Even at $15 an hour, they're still going to be spending everything they earn. So that's more money that gets pumped into the economy of love, whether it's a microeconomy or a macroeconomy, whether it's a small town, whether it's a big city or a state or the nation in whole.
Yeah, I think as a whole, but I think as an individual company, I don't know that you'd see those returns. But if it's working elsewhere, I mean, I'd be all for trying it here. I just think that... I don't know that logic totally makes sense, but I can't argue with empirical data. I mean, if it's working somewhere, then I would have to find a special reason why it wouldn't work here.
Well, you look at Walmart. Walmart's the biggest employer of people, and, you know, biggest private employer of workers in the United States. I mean, the whole business model is paying their workers so less that, you know, they decimate communities for every employee that Walmart hires. 1.4 American workers is displaced from a job from elsewhere, and when they move into these communities, it brings the wage structure down everywhere, and so the whole town eventually can only afford to shop at Walmart. So, you know, so sometimes these economic principles are actually counterintuitive. You know, it's intuitive to believe that paying workers less is better for small business. It's intuitive to think that giving tax breaks to the rich is actually going to trickle down and benefit the rest of us. But empirical evidence shows us it's actually often the reverse to intuition.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure I agree with the level that you're saying there, because based on, you know, my education, I mean, sure. You talk about investments as though that does nothing for people, but it does. I mean, you invest in a company, that company uses those resources to pay workers. I mean, they use it to employ people. It is interesting when you talk about these quick little trades, you know, to really short term, you know, minute to minute trading, that sort of thing. I could understand why that doesn't end up benefiting somebody,
but look at business today. The corporations in this country are more profitable than any other point in this nation's history. Corporations are sitting on a record $3 trillion worth of cash. Where are the jobs? And there's no jobs because you've got a whole consumer underclass that has no money to spend.
Yeah, that is interesting. That's an interesting stat. I want to look more into that. Because so what you're saying is basically corporations are making more money than ever, yet there aren't as many jobs. Is that?
And not only is there's not as many jobs, you know, there's not as many well-paid jobs because and companies aren't hiring because, you know, they don't need to, you know, meet the demand of a consumer class that has money. So, you know, these corporations are profitable by, you know, buying and selling their own stock at the moment.
Well, that doesn't make any sense to me based on my economics training. I don't know how that would work. That seems like one of those impossible paradoxes. But I think that I could go for that. I mean, I could go for the part where it does not make any sense that corporations would be making more money than ever, yet we'd have fewer jobs. I mean, something needs to be done about that. And record income disparity. Even if you want to say you're a conservative, well, conservatives of however many years ago, let's say 20, 30 years ago, when income disparity wasn't so record high, I mean, were they happy with things? I mean, it's weird how no matter where we are, you know, conservatives are fighting for more, or fighting for, you know, like take the corporate tax rate. Like you said, it used to be way higher. But it's like no matter where we are, it needs to be lower. Well, to me, that signals that maybe it's not, you know, maybe they don't have a specific good number in mind and they're just always fighting for something lower. I don't know if that made sense, but yeah. I would be, even if you could say that, essentially what I'm saying is, even if you had a conservative bent, it would be completely dependent on the facts of the time. You know, I mean, maybe conservatism or republicanism would make more sense, you know, I don't know, 50 years ago when the disparity wasn't as great and the taxes were bigger, but now maybe it makes no sense. So that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, the problem is that conservatism on itself in this country has become so irresponsible. You know, conservatism, you know, it should always be a good counterweight to liberalism as well. And, you know, somewhere, you know, whether, you know, to use, a, you know, the center line as a metaphor, somewhere between 5% of each side of that line is where healthy democracies have kind of operated. Sometimes parties go too far to the left and conservatism brings it back to just to the middle or to just the right side of the middle. And that's how Australia works and many countries in Western Europe works. And that's how America worked for, you know, that the most economic prosperous period of this country, you know, from the 40s to the 70s, when Republicans came into office after the FDR's New Deal. They didn't try and dismantle these social reforms like Social Security, Medicare, you know, unions, you know, collective bargaining, and so forth. But the Republican Party has become so radical and so right and such an outlier that if you took the most extreme right winger in a country like Australia or Britain, they would still be a Democrat, and transplant them to America, they would still be a Democrat here. And, you know, as I said, you know, we talked about earlier, Eisenhower to drop the top margin rate from 91% being moral. But this Republican Party does not a Republican Party of your dad or your grandfather, is just so ideologically driven by this mantra to destroy government wherever it finds it and send us, you know, continuing on this never-ending loop to the bottom.
But it's not like they do. I mean, they end up spending more when they're in power, right? I mean,
yeah.
That's the weird thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, Bush turned a Clinton surplus into $1.3 trillion deficit, an annual deficit. And Obama has cut deficit spending from $1.3 trillion it inherited to about $400 billion. So, you know, when the Republicans say Obama is a big spending liberal, in fact, it's the opposite. He's cut spending, you know, more dramatically than any president, you know, since World War II.
Sure. And, one thing that, and I agree with what you said earlier, and one thing that turns me off so much about politics in general is that the left has had to ratchet up in response to how ideological the right is. And oftentimes that turns me off. I mean, when I'm hearing extreme statements from either side, I don't really like it. Though I probably agree with where they're coming from on the left, I have a hard time. I hate that that's what we've come to. I mean, we have to, get it, yep. again, to reference the echo chambers. I mean, we have to like yep. one up each other with this rhetoric, and it's like, ah, I can't yeah. do it. That's why I finally registered to vote, but I feel so useless, but I'm going to do it.
Yeah. and I mean, that's great. I mean, you know, part of my problem is with the U.S. politics is my beef is with the Democratic Party because they just sold out liberals. I mean, economically, there's not much difference between the Democrats and the Republican parties these days, even though the Democrats don't outwardly support, you know, trickle-down economics. They've totally abandoned the working class under Clinton, you know, by embracing free trade, by gutting welfare, by, you know, destroying the unions, by embracing deregulating Wall Street. And, you know, unwittingly, it was Clinton Democrats, not liberals, but Clinton Democrats, which actually fueled the Christian right. And the speech I gave in Tulsa was how the collapse of liberalism in this country also means the death of secularism in this country. And you only have to look at the fact that the Christian right only emerged at the same time that liberalism collapsed. Liberalism collapsed in this country under Reagan in 1980. And that's when the Christian right emerged as a political powerhouse that it has become today. It's the same reason that there's no Christian fundamentalist political party which has any vocal say in politics in Western Europe and Australia, because you have a healthy, thriving liberal democracy. And where you have a healthy, thriving liberal democracy, where the economic needs of the people are being met, sought, you know, right with far right wing Christian religious ideologies aren't sought out by the people. And when you take economic issues off the table, which is what Democrats have done under Clinton by embracing the sanctity of the free market, all that's left to distinguish the two parties are the cultural issues, God, guns, and gays.
Yeah.
And in many ways, you know, Clinton Democrats unwittingly fueled the Christian right, which is, you know, an atheist, a secularist, and a secularist can't be a Republican. I mean, you can't be, be supportive of the Christian right.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. But let's go back to, you mentioned earlier, S.E. Cupp. I don't know if you saw the video she did that I referenced on my last show about atheism and, you know, atheist Republicans. Did you happen to catch that?
I watched about a minute. I despise it.
Well, it was only a minute 35, so you're okay, qualified to talk.
Yeah, well, I saw it, man.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I thought it was fairly ridiculous. And I thought it was I'm uncomfortable with it. It felt, I don't want to draw a distasteful comparison, but it just felt like
I know where you're going.
It just felt like somebody who's just clinging to abuse, you know, like when an atheist says like, oh, I understand the healthy role that religion plays in society, or, you know, when she's pandering to a Republican audience, it just feels like icky to me. It's just like, ugh, I don't know. It feels like, what's this?
Like a rape shower after it.
Yeah. It feels like, was it Stockholm syndrome or something? Is that what it is? It feels like that to me. It's one thing to say.
You want to say to her, blink twice if you need rescuing.
Yeah. No, I mean, she definitely does. I don't mean to say that's not her earnest opinion. I think it is her earnest opinion, but it just feels like she's having to go out of her way to. She says she's an atheist, but the way she talks about religion, I mean, I don't think it's the fact that she could be. Did you say she's a libertarian? I don't actually know anything about her.
Yeah, she is.
Oh, okay. Because she was referred to as, I mean, she kind of spoke as though she was Republican, or at least she was speaking for Republicans.
She's a Republican. She's a Republican.
Okay, but I see. So she's not identifying as third party or anything. She's just.
No.
Okay. Because there is a Libertarian Party. I mean.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's the Libertarian wing of the Republican Party.
Okay. Just, I really don't, I can't stand
this
main network television or whatever it is, or CNN, or I don't watch any of that, but yeah, okay. So she's obviously pandering to religion, I mean, to the religious right, and the idea that religion plays any sort of positive role in politics to me is just insane. So I found that quite objectionable.
Well, I just the level of cognitive dissonance or even complete ignorance where she spoke about that she doesn't believe that atheists are you know, a polarized or alienated in, you know, right, U.S. political discourse. I mean, you know, still today in 2014, there's got to be at least, what, you know, there's 535, you know, congressmen, you know, U.S. congressmen.
Sure.
There's got to be at least 100 atheists. But not one of them has come forward. I mean, you know, S.E. Cupp seems, you know, completely ignorant of the fact that, you know, polls show and studies show that atheists remain still to this day the most distrusted minority group in the country. And so for her to say that, you know, pretend like atheists have still, you know, have got it easy and she doesn't understand the, you know, the vigor that, you know, secular atheist groups fight for, you know, equal rights, or you know, or the defending of secularism in America, you know, is completely loopy.
Yeah, it seemed really backwards that, and it sounded like, sure, yeah, republicanism or Republicans, you know, they're totally friendly to atheists as long as you like submit to their, you know, yeah, their authority in a lot of things. Like I disagreed with that a lot, and I also, go ahead.
It was like listening to Clive and Bundy, you know, or Phil Robinson from Duck Dynasty say, you know, black people had it better under slavery.
Well, I don't know if I go that far, but I do see the comparison. But and she also said that you know, liberals are hostile to intellectuals, whereas, you know, Republicans apparently aren't. That was a little backwards to me. I mean, I could pick a few examples, I think, maybe, of where liberals have been hostile to intellectuals, but I can pick far more where conservatives are. That's for sure. So it was ridiculous. I still don't know that I would be fully convinced that atheists can't be Republicans. And I'm not trying to just get you on a technicality, but it seems tantamount to saying, you know, logical people can't be Republicans. I mean, it doesn't seem like you're making any more of a statement than that, are you? Or are you? I'm missing it.
I mean, the subtitle is important, you know, if facts and evidence matter. And, you know, I just present it in a way that, you know, okay, well, as I said earlier, that, you know, here's the Republican Party platform, and here's where the empirical evidence lays. I think that's it.
We've been battling, I guess, my terrible internet connection. So on behalf of both of us, I'm going to say fuck Comcast, and let's. If any small business internet provider wants to hit me up, you know, you got a potential customer here. That's for sure. If you have a good product, I don't know how that works, but okay. So thank you so much, CJ. I had a few more things I wanted to talk to you about, but you know, we'll have to leave it to another time, and maybe if I can get my internet fixed. Because thanks for battling through the terrible Skype connection. I would love to blame it on you, but I suspect it was me. I think I've been having problems lately.
No problem, mate. And thanks for having me on. And I wish I could talk a little longer, but it's time to cook those veggie sausages.
Oh, it is. And I wish I could have some of those. I'm going to have to go grab something to eat myself. All right. Thanks. And I can't wait to have you back again.
Thanks, Thomas. Thanks, mate. Talk to you soon.
Well, that wraps up the show for this week. Thanks again to CJ for powering through our Skype difficulties. That my internet will be better. That was frustrating. But again, thanks. And thanks for everyone who was listening for powering through it. Okay, we got a few new patrons I got to thank. Very happy to hear this news. Travis Saul, I might have gotten you last time, but just in case, I'm making sure. George Green, Alex Focus, Brian Lipscomb. Thank you guys so much. I really, 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 really appreciate that. And, I'm trying to, thank you guys with the bonus content and with the early episodes and all that stuff. So, it's the best. Seriously, each and every one of you, it's so helpful to the show. And, now I got to thank my big dogs, Jonathan Moyer, Havard S, John P, Bangs Naughty Bits, Giro 1369, Dale, Cincy Farmer, Jeremy Sharp, Jim, Matt, Garrett. Thank you, guys. Thank you, thank you, thank you, guys. If you want to get on this list of awesome, amazing people who support the show and who I love so much, go to patreon.com/atheist and check it out. All right. So like I said, next week, there will be some more Tom and Terry likely. And I've got a couple options as far as the rest of the content, so I haven't decided yet. So that's cool. It'll be fresh, for even for me. And so I'm not going to give it away yet. So I will see you guys next week. Have a good week, and hopefully the news will get a little better. I mean, we're on a roll. Not likely, though. All right, see you next week.